Good morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans.
Good morning. Welcome, everyone, to Democratic Perspective. I'm Gary LeMaster, and sitting in with me today is we're both filling in for the usual co-host, but sitting in is Klaus von Studenheim.
Klaus von Studenheim.
Sorry, I'll never get that right.
Yeah, you'll get it eventually.
And we're honored to have a guest today, Alessandra Soler, who is the executive director of the ACLU of Arizona. She spoke last Thursday to a record crowd at the Democrats of the Red Rocks meeting. For some reason, it seems that people are a little concerned about civil liberties in the coming administration. So welcome, Alessandra.
Oh, thank you so much, Gary, Klaus, for the invitation, and I'm really glad to be here.
Let's start out just explaining, maybe you can explain what the ACLU really does and what
sure.
it's about.
No, I appreciate that question because we've over the years, we've done a lot of sort of studies, and apparently the ACLU has 84% name recognition, but the majority of people do not know what we do. And so I appreciate that. I mean, we are an organization that defends everyone's rights, right? And so that means we don't pick and choose who our clients are. We file lawsuits. That's one way of defending people's rights. We engage in advocacy at the legislatures. We organize people. We do community outreach. All of it to both protect, defend, and expand people's constitutional rights.
I should probably point out what ACLU stands for. It's American Civil Liberties Union, right?
Right. American Civil Liberties. And we are I do want to point out, we're a nonpartisan organization. We do not, unlike, Planned Parenthood, they're obviously one of our allies, but they take positions on elected officials. So we do not endorse candidates for office or oppose candidates for office, and we're completely nonpartisan.
I'm always kind of surprised, though, how the conservatives who seem to be so intent on defending the Constitution so dislike the ACLU because you seem to constantly trip them up in their plans to take away people's liberties. So.
Right. Look, honestly, Gary, it depends on the issue. We have conservative allies that we have worked with on issues related to privacy and excessive government surveillance. During even the USA Patriot Act, I think there were a lot of Sensenbrenner came out afterwards and said, and he was one of the most powerful Republicans in Congress and said, we essentially made a mistake and we went too far too fast with Patriot Act. So it depends on the issues. Obviously, even on gay rights and gay marriage, many conservatives have supported gay marriage. And but there are other areas where we just don't have as much conservative support, at least public conservative support.
For a little background, let me ask, what got you involved with the ACLU? I happen to be a card-carrying member.
Sure, sure.
But you've been in it far longer than I expected.
Yeah. I'll tell you a little story about when I was, when I was in high school, I was the newspaper editor, and we were. I've always had a passion for journalism, and we were in a county, Miami-Dade County, that had a very strict prior restraint policy, which means that the principals would basically allowed in Miami-Dade County, they were allowed to censor the student newspapers.
Had the same experience in Germany.
Yeah. Where they were reading it and deleting everything that was you couldn't write about birth control, you couldn't write about protests, things that kids want to write about.
They tried to in Berlin. I never showed them the paper until it was already
right. Exactly.
They kicked me off eventually.
Good plan.
What we did was we contacted the ACLU and they were extremely supportive, and we ended up with their help organizing and mobilizing a bunch of students to go downtown and lobby the school board for a better policy that really respected student free speech rights. And so they were instrumental in that, and that really got me interested in the organization, and that was when I was in high school. And then I started working. I became a journalist after that. And I think, you know, I grew up with my father is from Argentina, and he grew up, you know, he had many relatives who were still in Argentina during the military dictatorships. And so he really embraced the concept of sort of transparency. And obviously dictatorship was the antithesis. Those dictatorships were the antithesis of democracy. And he always embraced these values that are very important to the ACLU: transparency, government accountability, you know, a free people and a free press. And so these were always important to our family. And when I left the newspaper, I worked for the newspaper for a couple of years after graduating and then moved to New Orleans. And that's when I got my first ACLU job in New Orleans. And so that was in 99. And it's been ever since then.
And how long have you been in Arizona?
I've been in Arizona for 10 years.
Wow.
So I've worked for the ACLU in Louisiana, and then I worked for them in Florida, where my family is from, and then moved here in 2006.
Maybe we just give a brief background on how the ACLU came into being and
sure.
What its primary focus is.
Yeah, you know, we were founded in 1920, and at the height of the Red Scare. At that time, the Attorney General, a gentleman by the name of Mitchell Palmer, was arresting and deporting immigrants who had what they called radical views. And so there had not been, I mean, women were still struggling. They had not been, well, that was the year that they got the right to vote. But in the beginning, that when we were founded, it was founded by a group of activists who were pushing for women's rights and the rights of immigrants to express themselves. It was 1920, and no law in the country had been struck down for violating the First Amendment. And this was at a time when people were protesting, you know, they were protesting the war, they were protesting World War One. I mean, and people were getting arrested left and right, and no one was actually challenging government attempts to stifle free speech. And so we came together. It was a group of activists, including Roger Baldwin, and they formed the ACLU. And so since then, we have, you know, that has been our role, is really being the kind of the watchdog, the check on government abuses of power, where they violate those key rights that are spelled out in the Bill of Rights. We really focus on the Bill of Rights, you know, those first 10 amendments, and then, you know, some key other amendments that protect people's voting rights, for example, and women's rights.
Klaus, do you have a question you want to ask? I can keep rambling here.
One of the things that I was curious about, you know, Trump's attempt to pass libel laws that would restrict freedom of speech, and I was wondering, whether you have an opinion, wouldn't even very conservative judges, like the ones he plans to appoint, still, I mean, the First Amendment is such a profound basis of law in the United States, and it's hard for me to imagine that even conservative Supreme Court justices would limit the First Amendment.
I agree with you, Klaus. That is, I agree wholeheartedly. That is the one issue that I think most of the members of the Supreme Court, both the liberal and conservative members, are going to agree upon. And we have in this country a very rich history of respecting the freedom of the press. And, you know, it's right now he's got this sort of love-hate relationship with the press, right? He's been communicating through social media with the American public. And has been very limiting the access of the press to him. I think every, you know, reporters are just stunned that he hasn't had a press conference.
It's kind of odd, given the fact that I don't think he would have been elected had it not been
for the press,
for the coziness with the media.
Yeah, you know, and look, I mean, that's my background. I think that the media plays an extremely important role. They do investigations, they expose misconduct, and they're going to be on him, just like they've been on Obama and every other president. You know, I mean, I think that's exactly their role. And that's what is the basis of our democracy, is a free press. And for him to attack the press, I think, is fundamentally attack on a key American value. And I think you're right. I mean, Scalia has been good on free speech, I'm drawing a blank. The Chief Justice has
Roberts,
as well, and Roberts has. Yeah. So he's very pro free speech.
The other things Trump has made threats, I would consider them threats anyway, during the campaign is to deport immigrants, to create a Muslim registry. There's to limit free speech, to sue the press. There's been just a raft of threats. And I suspect that's why we had such a large turnout at the for your talk at Democrats of the Red Rocks. So what are your plans? What is the ACLU preparing?
Sure.
What are we doing going forward?
Well, first of all, for your listeners, there, if you do a Google search for, if you go on our website at ACLU.org and you just search for Trump memos, we did an excellent analysis of how these campaign promises that Trump made before he was elected, how they violate the Constitution. And we go in great detail about these various different proposals. So I would definitely urge your listeners to check that out. So what are we doing? I mean, I think that, look, we're operating right now on hypotheticals. The one thing that we are doing, and I talked a little bit about with the group last week, was we're trying to I mean, obviously, we want to be strategic about our litigation and think about, we would be ready to go to court. I mean, there's some of those, if he begins, for example, conducting, unlawful raids, I mean, to targeting immigrants, I mean, obviously, that is something that's going to violate the Fourth Amendment, and we would be prepared to go to court to challenge that. There are other policy proposals like the NCERS. NCERS was the registry system that we had where Muslim immigrants had to register. We never, ever caught one terrorist under that program because, you know what, terrorists aren't going to show up and, turn themselves in to the government.
Well, the questions that they asked were so absurd. It was like, are you a terrorist?
Exactly.
Do you know how to make a bomb? I mean, these things were, any real terrorist is never going to answer those.
I mean, but the reality is that program was frightening, and it tore families apart, and it was very, very scary for many people, for many Muslims and immigrants living in this country to have to do that. And, I remember after 9/11, they were interviewing Muslims in Florida where I was. Just to kind of step back to your initial question, what we're doing is we're preparing, we will be prepared to litigate. We will be also, we're devoting more resources to advocacy, both at the state legislatures, because I think a lot of them are going to be emboldened to try to pass many, many bills that are mirror his federal agenda. We are ready to lobby and against some of these proposals in Congress, and we'll go to court. I mean, we are historically, we're a legal organization. We're a legal services organization. We take no government money, obviously, because we sue the government. But we'll be prepared to go to court and for some of these very, very egregious measures. I mean, I'm very concerned, as because we're in Arizona, about the immigration piece. There's, he's been threatening, or he's the DACA piece. There are many. We've been getting a lot of calls from young immigrants and their families who are terrified. They've turned themselves in. They've applied for this deferred action program where their deportations have been suspended. These are some of the most talented, smartest, hardworking immigrants that we have in this state, in this country, and now they could be deported to countries where they don't even speak the language.
We should define DACA.
DACA, yeah, deferred arrival childhood.
I forget what.
DACA. Essentially, it's a program that, for a period of 2 years, suspended the deportations of young immigrants who've been living in this country for many, many years. And so they were essentially got a reprieve where they were given status to be here and work permits to be here over a period of 2 years.
These are people that were brought into the U.S. by their parents
right. At
a very young age.
Right.
And they've never known their native-born country. They've only known the U.S. That this is where their family is. It's where their friends are. It's where their jobs are.
Right.
And the thought of deporting these people to a country that they've they've only lived in, you know, maybe for 2 or 3 years of their lives is kind of hard to imagine.
I mean, not to mention the fact that, you know, mass deportations like that would have a profound effect on the economy. I mean, these 11 undocumented immigrants, they work, they don't get welfare, they all work, and they're an important part of the workforce, and if they're suddenly gone, that will leave a gaping hole. We'll leave gaping holes in a bunch of places.
It's estimated that, if my memory serves me correctly, that undocumented workers contribute $12 billion in taxes and Medicare and Social Security each year. So deporting all of those people would be devastating. You know, they receive none of the benefits of that. And deporting them would be devastating for the rest of us.
And there have been plenty of studies to show that they contribute far more than they utilize in terms of services. But I think what's going to be interesting to your point, Klaus, about you know how much they contribute to the economy is how are the states going to respond to that? Because places like Ducey has been making a concerted effort to develop stronger, more positive relationships with our Mexican trade partners. He had a press conference a couple of weeks ago after Lucid Technologies opened up a manufacturing plant in Casa Grande. They have manufacturing facilities in both Sonora, Mexico, and in Arizona. And he had a press conference with the Sonoran governor. He has been really trying to present this sort of image of being the kinder, more welcoming governor compared to Jan Brewer for obvious reasons, because Mexico is such an important trade partner. And so it's going to be interesting to see how much the business community pushes back against some of these Trump proposals, these anti-immigrant proposals. I would hope that they would be more aggressive than they have been in the past.
Already, if you go down to Douglas or any of the cities along the border, because of the fence that we have now, it's already been devastating, you know, business-wise, to American cities along the border, because it's just too difficult for Mexicans to come into the U.S. to do some basic shopping, which they used to be able to just simply walk across the border and walk back home. But for Arizona to be deporting people and in favor of putting up a large wall is kind of like shooting ourselves in the foot repeatedly, because it's so much of our economy.
Well, and he's backtracked a little bit on the wall. I think his appointment of John Kelly obviously Kelly is going to be more pro-militarization of the Border Patrol. I think the concern that we have, he may not necessarily have the resources. Congress may not have the resources to build a wall. You physically cannot build a wall. Also, in a lot of areas, for example, in Arizona, where the Tohono O'odham Nation straddles both Mexico and the United States. But the concern that we have also is what we call the sort of the 100-mile radius zone, where right now Border Patrol has free reign within this 100 miles from the border, where they can conduct roving patrols. They have a tremendous amount of power to stop and question people and detain people. And Congress, for many, many years, the Republicans in Congress have argued that this 100-mile zone is limiting and that they want to expand that, which would mean that, they would have free reign to engage in these sort of enforcement activities far, far, miles away from the border, which I think would raise concerns, would really upset both conservatives and progressives alike.
Switching perhaps to a different topic, I was wondering what your thoughts, if any, were about about rescinding Roe versus Wade. I mean, this is something that Trump has promised, but isn't there a long history of the Supreme Court respecting precedents and prior Supreme Court decisions and not, taking a 180-degree turn?
Yes, there is. And I think that's what we want to focus on. That's the hope, right, that we're hanging our hopes on that, on Supreme Court precedent, is that they are very, very hesitant, as we saw with the latest women's health case from Texas that went before the Supreme Court, to overturn case, you know, years of cases and case law. And what we're, I think it's going to be harder to do. I think women's health was an indication that was an example of where they said, well, maybe these, what happened with women's health was that they, the state of Texas had created all these barriers and for providers that they ended up having to close many, many clinics. And then what they uncovered was that although the proponents of these measures were arguing that it was for the health of the women, it had really nothing to do with women's health, and that they were really, their agenda was clearly to shut down abortion clinics, which created barriers for women. And so, you know, I think we will continue to see these piecemeal laws or efforts introduced at the legislature, at the legislatures to roll back or create more obstacles for women. I do think that the major fight in Congress is going to have to, is going to deal with defunding of Planned Parenthood, is kicking Planned Parenthood out of the Medicaid program. And now Medicaid does not fund, you know, they're only medically necessary abortions for women who are on Medicaid. And I think for many, many states, including Arizona, about 10% of the women who receive services from Planned Parenthood receive access. And so they're living in poverty, and these are the primary health services that they receive. You know, Planned Parenthood, despite the rhetoric, the majority of their services are women's health services, where women get services.
The vast majority.
The vast majority, yes, yes, where they're getting services for, you know, their annual pap smears, for treatment, for birth control.
I think one of the problems is that, and it was smart on conservatives' part, is that they have, you know, kind of tended to put forward judges that are more ideological, mm-hmm. from you know, for federal judges. And during the Obama administration, they blocked many nominees for judge. In many cases, they wouldn't even put forward any candidates from their state for Obama to pick from. So there's a huge void of federal judges now that's been created over the past
right.
8 years. And now their hope is they're going to pack those
right.
Vacancies with very ideological people. And those are the people that ultimately end up in appellate courts and
sure.
and in the Supreme Court.
I mean, I agree with you, Gary, but I think I, you know, I still have faith in the justice system. And, you know, I'll give you an example. I mean, look, the judge in the Arpaio case is Maurice Snow, was appointed by Bush, who is conservative. He's a Republican. He was general counsel for the Mormon Church and has ended up being, you know, he's one of the most knowledgeable judges when it comes to immigration issues. And we, you know, I mean, he obviously, Arpaio upset him for good reason. And so I hope that certainly at the federal, you know, in Arizona, I mean, we have a good group of federal judges that are impartial. And, you know, when we try to be strategic, as I said, you know, about which cases we litigate. Not necessarily all issues are ripe for litigation. And abortion, Klaus, is one of them. You know, it's risky when you do decide to litigate, certainly outside of this Ninth Circuit where we have more favorable judges, right?
How do you choose which cases to litigate?
Well, I mean, that's obviously one factor, is we don't want to create bad case law. And, you know, we look at whether or not we have a strong plaintiffs. We look at whether or not it's a high impact case. We typically do not engage in, you know, individual lawsuits where, for example, it's individual, you know, lawsuits between individuals or lawsuits that are on behalf of one individual. Many of our cases are class action lawsuits where we represent hundreds, maybe thousands of people, because those are the lawsuits that have the greatest impact. And so we'll choose the cases based off of, they initially come into our office from the community, which is why it's so important that we hear from your communities about what's going on, where we'll get a complaint, then we'll investigate, and then, you know, decide if this is something that we have to litigate. So maybe a lot of times we can send a demand letter. And, you know, I'll give you an example. At the I think it was the Prescott Police Department, there was like this giant religious scripture, a banner of a religious scripture in the Prescott Police Department. And we sent them a letter and we said, well, you know, that's, what if you have people walking into the police department who aren't Christian? It's divisive and you should take it down. And they did. And so, you know, many of our complaints are resolved through what we call non-litigation advocacy, where we just send a letter and then they end up changing their practices. But if we have to, we will go to court, and we decide based off of, we look at if it's a strategic priority area for us. We have four strategic priority areas. It's education, it is immigration, it's LGBT rights, and it's criminal justice reform. That obviously helps. But then we also look at whether or not there are other, a lot of times we're in the best position to do the litigating. We don't want to duplicate efforts. So if there's another organization that's already litigating it, we obviously will decide not to pursue it.
Last week you told a very moving story about a Somali kid in school, and I thought it was very poignant because it's a real life story, and I wonder whether you could just briefly repeat that as the kind of work that you do.
Sure. So we came across this this case because we were contacted by the mother of a little boy. He's a Somalian immigrant. He was 11 years old. And he was in sixth grade, and he was expelled from his charter school after his mother filed a complaint on behalf of her son against a teacher. And the teacher, this was before the election, said to him, and I'm quoting this, "All you Muslims think you're so smart." She basically then went on a rant and started talking about Donald Trump in the classroom. She said, "I can't wait until Trump is elected. He's going to deport all you Muslims. Muslims shouldn't be given visas. They'll probably take away your visa and deport you. You're going to be the next terrorist, I bet." So this is wasn't the first time that the boy heard this. I think this was the last incident that really triggered him, his complaint to his mother, because I think the teacher obviously went too far. And the teacher, this was a woman. She's an also an immigrant. She was terrified. She went and filed a complaint with the vice principal, and the vice principal found that her, didn't believe the son, and ended up expelling the boy, and the he forced the mother to sign what's called a voluntary withdrawal, which happens very, very often in charter schools, where they don't want to have a record of an expulsion because expulsions have to be reported to the federal government. So they basically urge the parents to do what's called a voluntary withdrawal.
What
they also kicked out the sister, right?
They also, and then they ended up kicking out, even though the sister, a 7-year-old sister, had nothing to do with the incident, she ended up being expelled as well.
What part did the fact that it was a charter school play in this case versus a traditional public school?
I mean, I think the problem here is that there's no accountability with the charter school. So the example here is we filed a complaint with the charter school board, but because the charter school board only has two functions, the charter school boards are responsible for the fiduciary and the academic oversight of the schools. And so they did not accept the complaint that dealt with religious discrimination. And so that is part of the problem with charter schools, is that there is no accountability, and that they're not, even though they're public schools and they're not supposed to discriminate on the basis of religion and race and national origin, they do, and then there's no way for the victims to vindicate themselves or for them to seek justice, because no one is investigating these matters. So the issue went before the school board. They discussed it, and they said, wow, this is outrageous, but they didn't do anything. And so we ended up filing a complaint with the Federal Department of Education, and then now they are looking at investigating, deciding whether or not to investigate. But this is an example of why we need greater accountability for charter schools. They're public schools, but they all, you know, they can't.
They're public schools in the fact that they take public funds.
Exactly. But they're being privately run.
Funds. Right. So they're privately run, they take taxpayer funds, but unlike traditional public schools, they have no accountability for how they spend their money.
Right.
They can be very selective on who they choose as students, so they can kind of pack the schools with bright students to make their performance look better.
And that's what prompted it, just to put it in the bigger picture context. You know, we've been getting a lot of complaints from parents who send their children to charter schools. And the complaints are from everything from the admissions process to enrollment to these voluntary withdrawals because they're, you know, they're kind of counseled out if they don't meet these rigorous academic standards. And then it's the whole pipeline, right? Then suspension and expulsion. So we're doing investigation where we're looking at the just looking at the numbers, right? And looking at how the charter schools compare to the public schools with regard to pushing these children out of schools, because we have one of the highest charter school rates per capita, and we're considered the birthplace of charter schools. I think New Orleans has the number one in terms of sheer number of charter schools. Michigan is number two, but per capita we have a much higher number. And so what we're saying is, look, these are publicly funded schools, and they need to be held accountable, especially when it comes to the treatment of students and the discriminatory treatment.
There's all kinds of funny business that's been going on in Arizona with charter schools and STOs and, you know, the student tuition, I forget what the old stands
student
for.
Student tuition organizations, exactly.
The biggest one is owned by the guy who pushed the bill through the legislature, as I understand it.
Right. So, yes. Yeah. So Steve Yarbrough, who is now the new, he's going to be the president of the Senate, ran his own school tuition organization. And over the years, there have been many, many bills that have come before him. And I think when it comes to church-state issues in the state of Arizona, this is the biggest church-state issue that the state has faced. Because what we're doing is we're transferring millions and millions of dollars from the public fund, from the general fund, to the coffers of private religious institutions, and it's millions of dollars, and that is how we are sustaining. Taxpayers are basically sustaining and paying for these private sectarian organizations, is egregious.
Has that ever been litigated, the fact that this really violates the separation of church and state?
Yes, we actually litigated, and I'll tell you, we lost. And so we lost, and it's on what grounds? You know, we lost on a technical ground over standing, and it had been many, many years of litigation. And we also lost on, the argument was that this money was never in the school coffers or public general fund to begin with. That's what they claimed. And so the court did rule that essentially because it's a tax credit, that it wasn't government money to begin with, that this is always taxpayer funds. And so we obviously disagreed with that. But, I mean, that's the legal argument. I think the bigger picture argument is that the STO program was intended to help students in failing public schools, right? That was the purpose of it. They sold it to the legislature in order to help.
The alleged purpose, right?
Right, the alleged purpose. And now, and there have been many of investigative pieces that have shown that 80% of the students that are benefiting from these STOs are private school students. So what we're doing is subsidizing private school education rather than helping kids in failing schools maybe access or with other possibilities.
And this is the national future under Trump, because his appointee to the Department of Education, his secretary, is someone who has spent millions of dollars trying to do away with public schools and take the money from public schools and give it to vouchers and to charter schools and private schools.
Exactly. That's Betsy DeVos, is the incoming Secretary of Education. And that's a huge concern. I mean, given where the state of affairs with regard to education here in Arizona, I mean, I have three kids in public schools. I have two eight-year-old twins and a 12-year-old, and they are in huge classrooms. This is a real, real big concern, certainly for me as a mother, but for many people across the country, including the businesses, the business community, although I don't think they've been, again, as outspoken as they should be. But, you know, that's what makes us competitive. Going back to your point, Klaus, about the economy. And you know, we need kids who are educated, who are good at math and science, who can compete with, we need to compete with other nations. And education has not been a priority.
And public schools are the great leveler. They're
right.
What allow people from poor backgrounds to have a chance to improve themselves. If they can't get into good schools, then we kind of just throw away their minds and their talents.
Well, look, I mean, it's no coincidence that in Arizona, 52% of the children who are enrolled in public schools are Latino. If you look at the enrollment rates at the charter schools, especially the high-performing charters, they're not reflective of the communities they serve or even the communities where they are located. You know, many of these charter schools set up shop in predominantly, certainly in Phoenix and some of the best, you know, in Latino neighborhoods, and they are not pulling in kids from that neighborhood.
This is what has really allowed a resegregation of our
right.
population. In Minnesota, where I worked for many years, I was reading an article in their newspaper that their schools are now more segregated. Mm-hmm. They have a great school system. But their schools are now more segregated than they were prior to the Civil Rights Act.
Wow, yeah.
And they're not unique in that.
No.
Has been going on across the country. Speaking of that, you know, since before and after the election, there's been hundreds of racial incidents around the country, swastikas painted on schools and on Muslim mosques, et cetera. And there's been this ongoing thing, it's kind of gotten lost in the election, this ongoing problem of police shooting unarmed black people. And there have been hundreds and hundreds of incidents of this. And it doesn't seem to be any real movement to change that. You know, we just had a hung jury in, was it South Carolina, I think, that where Walter Scott was shot in the back as he was running away and he was unarmed. There was absolutely no reason to shoot him. And there's a question if there's going to be a second trial. What can be done? I mean, I've been tracking this for years.
Yeah.
And it goes on and on and on.
This is another example, Klaus, where, you know, when we talk about Supreme Court precedent and precedent in this country is that it is very, very difficult to successfully win or prosecute police officers who engage in excessive use of force when you're in a courtroom, because we have years and decades of litigation that finds it's a very low standard. I mean, the officer, in many instances, can shoot to kill if they feel the least bit threatened. And, you know, that standard is very, very low, and it's very, very difficult to secure prosecutions, even in those kind of egregious cases, like in the case of Walter Scott.
It's sort of like stand your ground on steroids.
It is. And, you know, we've had a lot of conversations within the ACLU and also with our external allies, and we've been approaching it now through advocacy with police departments and city councils to try to change those policies. And there has been some success. There have been changes in police departments across the country who are now recognizing that de-escalation shouldn't be buried in the, you know, in that 50-page use of force policy, that it should be, you know, that they need to embrace it, and they need to train their officers on these de-escalation techniques. Many of the departments have been adopting these changes, I mean, obviously, because they're concerned about liability. So we as a strategy sometimes use, we'll file a lawsuit against the police department where we'll file a lawsuit for damages, which typically we do not do. But in the context of police and excessive use of force cases, that is oftentimes what will convince these police departments to take a step back and say, wait, maybe we should revisit this and consider, you know, training our officers to do de-escalation or train them to not engage in discriminatory practices. But it is a challenge because it's not an easy conversation that many police departments are resistant. There have been calls now in many states throughout the country for greater oversight of of police civilian oversight. And that's obviously has its own set of problems because without real subpoena power, a lot of these boards are not effective. And so you're
talking about civilian review boards.
Yeah, I mean, that's among, when we talk about the solutions to this problem, I mean, those are some of the policy solutions is, you know.
I've had experience with those, and they are helpful. But like you say, they don't have subpoena power.
Right, and they could be, you know, they're only as strong as this, as the resources that they receive.
Frankly, in Minneapolis, they were weaker than the police union.
Right, exactly, and that's often the case. You know, I mean, we're based in Phoenix, and we've been working to try to incorporate some of these policy changes, and they're very resistant. They're very, very resistant. So many changes have come about through litigation, through where they've had to pay out large punitive damages. But it's going to be – we're concerned now, I mean, with reinstituting stop and frisk. I mean, obviously, we had a big case in New York, the stop and frisk case, where we challenged this practice because it was being applied disproportionately to Latinos and African Americans. And now, you know, Giuliani during the campaign was touting, and Trump during the campaign was touting how important stop and frisk was, even though it's been declared unconstitutional by a court of law, which he disputed during one of the debates. But that was, I turned it off after that because I was so upset.
We've been speaking with Alessandra Soler of the ACLU of Arizona, and you have your work cut out for you. I mean, it looks like this is going to be a particularly challenging time. I want to ask before we run out of time, where do you get your funding? I assume it's from memberships like mine.
Mine.
Thank you.
What can we do? How if somebody wants to become a member, it's not that expensive. It's a exceedingly worthwhile cause, as you can tell from this conversation. How does somebody go around about becoming a member?
And hasn't your membership taken a big jump just recently?
It has. We've gone from about 500,000 to 750,000 across the country.
It should be millions.
Yeah, it should be. But we need your help. And so we would urge you to visit our website, which is www.acluaz.org. Become a member. Donate to the ACLU. Donate to the ACLU and then donate to Planned Parenthood as your second check. I mean, that's what I tell people. But we rely on donations, private donations. We do not accept any government money. And so, you know, if you are thinking about making a year-end tax-deductible contribution to any organization, we would urge you to make that check to the ACLU, especially before December 31st, because it helps us plan for next year.
I do it every year.
Thank you.
Are you a 501c3? Are these?
We are, yes. We have membership dues are not tax-deductible, but any donation, yes, is tax-deductible. We have a foundation and a separate lobbying arm.
I think it's so important, given the statistic you mentioned at the meeting, that absolutely blew me away, is that there are almost 2,000 bills per year that challenge civil rights. Is that across the country?
No, that's across the country, yes. And, you know, we have... So there's a lot of bills. There's a lot of work to do to kind of push back and fight back against these things, which is why we need your help to make it happen.
Any closing statements you'd like to make quickly?
I just want to say that, you know, we have the huge fight for our lives, but I think I'm hopeful. I think with our collective power, our collective brain, our collective motivations, we can fight back and do it successfully. So let's not lose hope.
There is hope that, considering the fact that we finally got Joe Arpaio out of office.
We did, yes.
It wasn't necessarily the ACLU, but I'm sure you helped. And
well, it was our case that led to the criminal contempt charges.
Great.
Oh, yeah.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. And then voters decided that he wasn't fit to be the sheriff anymore.
And that's been true for some time, but they finally recognized it this past year. Just to wrap up, please join the ACLU. And I'd like to put in a plug for Democrats of the Red Rocks that supports us. They have a meeting every month. I don't know what the subject is for next month.
Next month is the general membership meeting.
Oh, that's right. It's on a Sunday, the 12th, I believe, January 12th, sometime around that time. Anyway,
it's January 22nd.
Okay.
5 o'clock.
So please attend. You can look it up on the website, Democrats of the Red Rocks. You can also check out our website, vvid.org, vvid.org. You can find all of our podcasts from previous programs on that site. Thanks, Alessandro.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.